this book is both an analysis of how we got to our current impasse in the war on terrorism and an argument about how to break that impasse, and specifically for greater congressional involvement in the processes of designing the underlying legal architecture that guides the conduct of this war.
Good morning and welcome to the Miller Center Forum. Our guest today is Benjamin Wittes. Ben Wittes is a fellow and research director in public law at the Brookings Institution. Interestingly, he does not have a law degree and yet writes more knowledgeably and speaks more knowledgeably about the law than most lawyers I know. Ben was educated at Oberlin College, where he went originally because of his interest in the French horn, but switched to law and has done so with some distinction. He spent several years as an editorial writer at the Washington Post and as a reporter and news editor at the Legal Times. Today, in addition to his tenure at the Brookings Institution, he's a columnist for the online edition of the New Republic, and he's a contributing editor to the Atlantic Monthly. In his book, Law and the Long War, The Future of Justice in the Age of Terror, he poses an interesting question, and that is, how do we construct a legal architecture that is adequate to the unique demands of the international fight against terrorists while still being responsive to the requirements of the United States Constitution? Wittes argues that the answers do not lie in trying to parse the Constitution or the historical debates over habeas corpus. In Law and the Long War, he suggests that a whole new architecture be developed and insists that the United States Congress be involved in drawing up the plans for this new architecture. Very provocative topic. Please welcome Benjamin Wittes.
Thanks very much. I wanted to start, if I could, by reading a very brief excerpt, which is actually the opening passage of the book, and then taking a poll of the audience regarding it. Reads as follows. The terrorist mastermind had slipped through their fingers before, and American forces were not about to let it happen again. At one point the previous year, they had actually arrested him. Not realizing who he was, they had let him go. Unable to track him down now, they managed instead to locate and detain his wife, who was living in a remote mountainous region. For several days, they interrogated her at an airbase, but she repeatedly insisted that he was dead. Finally, they tried a new tactic. They noisily put a plane on a nearby runway, its engines running. As the commanding officer later recalled, "We then informed her that the plane was there to take her three sons to a repressive country nearby unless she told us where her husband was and his aliases. If she did not do this, then she would have 2 minutes to say goodbye to her sons. We left her there for 10 minutes or so with paper and pencil to write down the information we required." Having threatened, in essence, to kill her sons, for nobody doubted what the secret police would do to them when they arrived at their destination, the interrogators got the information they wanted, and they got their man, disguised as a farm laborer, later that evening. So my question, quick show of hands, is how many of you think that tactic is okay? About half. All right, so now I'm going to tell you that I actually adjusted the facts of that anecdote a little bit. The plane was really a train. The region was not Afghanistan, but Germany. The year is 1946. And the person in question is not Khalid Sheikh Mohammed or Abu Zubaydah, but a man named Rudolf Höss, who's not to be confused with Rudolf Hess. But Rudolf Hess was the commandant of Auschwitz. The forces actually were British, not American. And so this is one of the great mass murderers of all time. It's a true story, the circumstances of his capture. And so I'm going to ask the question again. Now who thinks the tactic is OK? Actually, that's a sort of pretty surprising. Usually when I do this, I have a very small percentage who think it's okay at the outset, and a much larger percentage when they find out who it is. So this is an unusual audience in that regard. Normally, I present this anecdote as a kind of a vision of how hard a series of questions are that we've all labored as a society to make easy, and also how resistant they are to rule by a sort of abstract moral principle. That, you know, it's very easy to say we oppose coercive interrogation, and then you say, well, what if the coercive interrogation nets you Rudolf Höss, you know, who personally supervised 1.1 million murders or something. And one corollary of these issues being very hard to resolve on the basis of abstract principle is that they're very hard to have resolved by judges who are, after all, supposed to rule on the basis of principle. I wrote this book because I was tired of the pretense that has grown so common on both sides of the political spectrum in this area, that these issues are a whole lot easier than they actually are. And I grew tired as well of the increasing tendency of our society to resolve them by asking judges to do it for us. The book is both an analysis of sort of how we got to our current impasse in the war on terrorism and the sort of legal arguments around it, and an argument about how to break that impasse. And specifically, it's an argument for greater congressional involvement in the processes of designing the underlying, I call it in the book, for lack of a better word, legal architecture that kind of guides the conduct of this war. By legal architecture, I mean designing the rules under which we will conduct our side of the conflict, but also the rules under which we design those rules. Are they going to be decided through a series of litigations that take place over many years? Or are they going to be decided because we sit down in a deliberative fashion and make some decisions as to, you know, what we do want to do and what we don't want to do? And so the book is it's an immodest little effort to kind of rewrite the law of the war on terrorism across the entire range of the issues in which we are currently contesting. And broadly speaking, those are detention, interrogation, trial, to the extent that detainees are actually being put on trial, which is actually fairly limited, but we also fight about under what circumstances and under what rules they should be tried. Covert action, renditions, captures overseas, and surveillance, which is actually, in my view, the area in which we've done the most work and in some ways involves the hardest set of problems, probably have the most work to do in the long run. Now, the impasse that we've reached is itself remarkable and warrants, you know, a sort of moment of reflection. When 9/11 happened, you know, you can put yourself back in, it doesn't take a lot of conjuring to kind of put ourselves back in the sort of moment of incredible unity that we had. It wasn't that long ago. And actually, that unity it felt atypical, but it was in fact not atypical. And these are a series of areas that have traditionally not been all that political and not been all that politically divisive. I started writing about the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act as a young reporter at Legal Times in 1994. And I understood it at the time as an area that was entirely politically uncontroversial. This was an issue that had, it was a law that had generated in response to Watergate, initiated under the Ford administration, completed in the Carter administration, kind of lovingly cultivated under, you know, the Reagan, Bush, and by then the Clinton administrations. This was not a politically divisive area. And in fact, I believe that there had, at that time, never been a partisan vote on a matter related to FISA. It was just an accepted part of the intelligence infrastructure and the intelligence law infrastructure that, you know, both parties understood to be sort of above, it was not to say it was without controversy, but it was without partisan controversy. And that actually continues through the Patriot Act. You know, the Patriot Act is passed with just a very small handful of votes against it in either house. And yet now, this is barely 6 years later, 7 years later, these subjects are pervasively partisan. There is no component of it that is no longer partisan. It is not to say that at the end of the day we don't have strongly bipartisan votes, but the parties have a view on this subject in a way that they didn't before. The parties have a view about detention. And the most alarming aspect of this is that our political rhetoric is actually getting further apart, not closer. Usually, you know, you think of these things as having, one side presents a thesis, you have an antithesis, and then kind of over time you move closer together. And this is exactly what's not happening. What's happening here is that one side articulates a set of ideas, the other side objects, and they're growing further and further apart. So consider, for example, the issue of Guantanamo, which we think of as we're incredibly divided over Guantanamo, right? And yet, at the beginning of the war on terrorism, we were actually not very divided over Guantanamo. So when the Bush administration first begins bringing detainees to Guantanamo in January of 2002, Human Rights Watch, which has been one of the leading voices objecting to administration policy, issues a series of statements objecting. Now, what do they object to? They object to the fact that the detainees are being held in wire cages. They object to the fact that the detainees are being classified as unlawful enemy combatants without individualized hearings. And they object to the fact that the administration has decided that a Taliban soldier cannot, under any circumstances, be entitled to the status of prisoner of war. So that sounds like a pretty big divide. But actually, consider what was not in dispute. What was not in dispute was that you could hold the enemy. What was not in dispute was that you could hold the enemy at Guantanamo Bay. What was not in dispute was that you could hold the enemy for a really, really long time, as in to the end of hostilities, which may never happen. You know, we don't even really know what that means. Today, Human Rights Watch's position is that detention at Guantanamo is per se illegal, improper, that people there should be either released or tried in US federal court. So the gulf between the administration, and interestingly, the administration's position now is awfully close to what Human Rights Watch's position was in December of 2001 and January of 2002. That is, they're not holding anybody in wire cages. They've given everybody individual hearings. And a lot of people are being treated in a fashion much, much more close to that of a prisoner of war. And so, you know, even as the administration has moved closer to where their critics had been, the bar has moved too, and the gulf has actually widened a lot. Now, I argue that it's really easy this way. It allows everybody to sort of see this whole set of disputes in terms that are perfectly aligned with our kind of pre-existing political instincts. Liberals get to see conservatives as, you know, insufficiently attentive to liberty interests, as willing to ride roughshod over, you know, cherished values, et cetera. Conservatives get to see liberals as insufficiently attentive to security. It's the sort of equivalent of the old kind of soft on crime allegation, except that with this time, with the wrinkle that liberals will see this as crime, whereas a mature view would see it as war and something more serious even than crime. We all get to see it exactly the way we want to. But I would argue that it's both analytically wrong on its own terms, and it's extremely dangerous if the goal is to have, you know, some kind of an architecture, some kind of agreed upon rules in which we can prosecute a conflict that's frankly going to be with us for a long time on terms that we all accept as reasonable, just, lawful, fair. So everybody wants to have villains in their account of the war on terrorism, other than Al-Qaeda, I suppose. I don't really have a villain, but I do think this is a story in which there have been a lot of fools. So I wanted to try to think past some of these divisions, and I want to lay out very bluntly and directly what my underlying premises are. There are basically three. The first is that the war on terrorism is genuinely different from anything we've confronted before. We all try to do this by analogy. It's the criminal. You use the criminal law or the law of war. And my argument is that the analogies get you so far, but they eventually fail. You know, you can talk in the criminal law language, but we don't usually send predator missiles after criminal suspects. And so, you know, you can talk in the language of the laws of war, but in the laws of war, we don't adjudicate, you know, these things that look awfully like guilt and innocence determinations that lead to very long-term detentions of people under very murky circumstances. This is something new. It's something different. And we ought to treat it as something new and something different. This brings me to the second premise, which is that as such, it requires new legal regimes. It requires a body of law of its own. The criminal law develops, and the laws of war develop over many, many hundreds of years. They develop in this sort of evolutionary fashion. This is not going to develop that way. It's not going to develop that way because it presents all of a sudden in a way that you can't ignore. It requires global reach. It requires things that we don't have a lot of time to figure it out because we're doing it all at once. But it's going to, it's going to require that we develop a new set of systems, a new set of regimes. And that brings me to the third premise, which is that the proper forum to develop these regimes is not in a common law dialogue between the executive and judicial branches, but in the Congress of the United States, in dialogue with the executive about its needs in a sort of sustained and serious legislative effort. In other words, somehow we've gotten, as a society, very bogged down in this question of what the law is. It's a very earnest and very serious discussion, and we all feel it very acutely. You know, and it's the wrong question. The question is what the law should be, that we should imagine ourselves to be writing on a much blanker slate than we pretend to be. So we debate the role of the historic reach of habeas corpus instead of debating the question of what role we would want judges to play in adjudicating these questions. We ask whether the CIA violated some frankly very vague interrogation laws that really, if you read them, amount to don't do anything kind of too mean. Instead of saying, what guidance do we want? What do we want the limits to be? Under what circumstances should we be able to, you know, threaten Rudolf Hess's wife with killing her kids? And what circumstances don't we want that to be okay? My argument is really we don't have enough law here. It wasn't written for our current problems to the extent we have it. And the analogies that we try to draw between this area and the others will get you so far, and then they fail. This point was made rather vividly to me as I was completing the manuscript for this book, and the Supreme Court heard oral arguments in the latest round of Guantanamo litigation, which is really its third, all on the same question, which is not what can you do with detainees at Guantanamo or what legal process do they get, but does the federal court get to hear these cases at all? This is the third time the Supreme Court heard oral arguments in this case. And it was a completely riveting argument. You know, it had two of the great Supreme Court advocates of our time, the then Solicitor General Paul Clement and Seth Waxman, a former Solicitor General, both incredibly able advocates. And there is this moment when Seth Waxman was up there arguing on behalf of jurisdiction over Guantanamo. When he and Justice Scalia get into this extended colloquy over the question of whether the Isle of Jersey was or was not British sovereign territory for habeas purposes in I forget what century. And it's a remarkable moment because you say, you know, if I were Justice Scalia, I probably would have asked the same question. If I were Seth Waxman, I would have engaged, you know, I'm not criticizing either of them. But what does this have to do with the question of how you want to handle somebody who may or may not be an Al-Qaeda operative, and if he is an Al-Qaeda operative, may or may not be an extremely dangerous one, and what processes should be available to him, and what legal rights should attach to him in the context of those processes? The idea that you're going to decide that question based on the sovereignty status of the Isle of Jersey is, you know, is frankly laughable. It's a new kind of conflict, and everybody says that. You know, for back from the earliest days of the conflict, you know, Donald Rumsfeld wrote an op-ed in the New York Times that said headlined a new kind of war. Nobody objected. You know, everybody agrees that it's kind of a new kind of conflict. I want to go that extra step and say, in a new kind of conflict, you have to design a new kind of law for it, and in a way that is really more about, you know, a fifth grade civics class. If you went to a fifth grade civics class and you said, we're going to design a new body of law for a new type of conflict, a set of challenges that we really haven't faced before, where do you do that? The fifth grade civics class would have no trouble with this question. They would all raise their hands and say, you know, in the Congress, because Congress makes the law. And that's the sort of simple-minded approach that I propose here. Now, that said, simple-minded but very hard. It's one of the great games of this thing to try to make it easy. You know, how easy it is, how obvious it is that all you need to do is the following, you know, whether it's locking them all up or dumping them all in federal court or letting them all go. But what I've tried to do is actually unpack a little bit of the obviousness and talk about why it is A, non-obvious, and try to sketch out some legislative strategies across the areas that we're actually fighting about. So I'll summarize those very briefly, and then I'll open it up for questions. To me, the core, the heart and soul of the dispute is actually about detention. It's about the circumstances in which we're going to hold people extra-criminally whom we suspect of terrorist activities and how you want to think about that problem. I think one of the great errors of the current administration was to think about these detentions under the laws of war rather than to think of them simply, straightforwardly, as preventive detentions on a public safety rationale. And I think as we move forward, there's actually a fair bit of constitutional authority for the idea that you can do that sort of thing. And what I propose is to have is to decouple the detentions at Guantanamo and future ones like them from the laws of war, which really are a bad fit, and we can talk about why if you want to go down that road, and just treat them honestly and straightforwardly as preventive detentions that are supervised directly by the U.S. federal courts in somewhat the same way, for example, as state courts now authorize preventive detention of people who are seriously and dangerously mentally ill, or for immigration detainees who pose a hazard to the public. I want, in that context, to give detainees a great deal more process, more legal process, than they get under the current rules, even the current rules post Boumediene. And pivotally, I want the courts, right now what happens is the military decides who it wants to hold, they get to challenge that in federal court. We don't really know what that challenge looks like. And then after that, presumably if the government survives that challenge, that's it. They get, you know, they get held for as long as the government wants to hold them. I want to design it so that that federal court oversight is right up front, right at the beginning of the detention, and that the jurisdiction persists and the government has to keep coming back for extensions of it for as long as it wants the detention to persist. Concerning for those detainees who we're going to put on trial, and that is, you know, a subset of the larger group that we don't know what percentage it's going to be in the long run. We keep releasing people and we keep bringing more cases, so the percentage has gone up. But what I've proposed is a creation of a tribunal that kind of hybridizes elements of what is now the military commissions process and the trial regime in federal court. And I can talk more about that balancing act, which is actually a very complicated little corner of this thing. On interrogation, which is in some ways the most, interrogation is actually an area where there's been a huge amount of anxiety and debate about, but we've actually made an enormous amount of progress, which is to say that at the beginning of the conflict, we had no idea what the rules were for the military, and we had no idea either what the rules were for the CIA, and that the military side of that, which is, was by far the bigger problem in terms of the numbers. I mean, the CIA has held about 100 people since the beginning of the war on terrorism. The military currently holds about 26,000 people. So there's many decimal points difference between the two. And the military side has been quite encouragingly fixed, actually, between the McCain Amendment, which passed in the end of 2005, and a rewrite of the Army Field Manual that governs interrogations. We've really actually corrected the problem of military interrogations. Now, what I've proposed in the book is a sort of similar provision for the CIA that doesn't, as many members of Congress have sought to do, require that the CIA follow the military's guidance, but that the CIA publish and follow its own set of procedures regarding interrogations, so that we would, I believe, and again, we can talk about this, why this is, but I think the CIA has genuine reasons to use a different set of procedures than the military wants to use or the military will use. What right now, they're required to follow no set of procedures, and I think that's a situation that begs for a lot of anxiety, and I think it's very easily correctable with an appropriate and relatively narrow legal change. Finally, surveillance, which is actually, as I've said, the area in which we've done the most work, culminating in this last round of amendments to FISA, which happened over the summer. It's a tremendously difficult area, both because the technology is changing so dramatically fast, it's very hard to keep up with it, and also because it's hugely impeded by secrecy. We don't actually, to this day, still really know what the NSA's program consists of. But I'll throw out the following idea, which is, I think, the direction that the whole debate is going to go in the next 10 to 15 years. It used to be that we would say about surveillance that, you know, if the government collects information, it needs a warrant. If it's information specifically related to the content of your communications. Now, this idea does not easily survive a circumstance in which you're putting out enormous amounts of information about yourself on Facebook, on the whole cultural engagement between the individual and corporations, government, has changed very dramatically. The amount of data out there has changed enormously. And we're going to have to think very hard as a society about under what circumstances we want what level of scrutiny attached to the collection of that data. And right now, we have this absolutely irrational patchwork of rules governing collection of data by the government and by non-governmental actors, to the point that information about you is obtained by private parties and sold to the government because it wouldn't be lawful for the government to collect that information itself. I think this whole area is going to require a very extensive revision. And it's going to require a revision that really is sort of from the bottom up, from the ground up, because the sort of whole underlying basis of it has changed. And what I think is going to happen, and I think the direction that we're going to go, and probably should go, is toward a regime in which we're much more tolerant of collection, including government collection of data, that we sort of accept that a huge amount of data is out there, is going to be out there, and is going to be collected, and that we're much more rigorous than we are now about the terms of use of that data. That is, right now, the government has to jump through some fairly farcical procedural hoops in order to get information. But once it has it, there's essentially no rules about what it can do with it. The result is we actually don't know, to a large degree, what government does with information. And my suspicion is that that's exactly backwards, that we're paying too much attention to the circumstances of collection. We're putting weird restrictions and somewhat irrational restrictions on the collection of information. And we're not thinking hard enough about the rules of use of that information. And so I think that's sort of the direction that the surveillance arena is likely to go. And you see some of that in this latest round of FISA legislation, where Congress basically said to the executive, you know, go ahead, collect this, you know, whatever you're doing with these, you know, one-party overseas communications, but we really want the Inspector General of the Justice Department to audit everything. We really want, you know, we want to have a better sense of what's going on and how it's being used. So I'll stop there and take questions.
Let me start by sort of getting down to basics, Ben, if I may. You argue that the standard by which we judge surveillance techniques has been anchored in sort of old notions arising under the Fourth Amendment, that we have a right to be secure in our home, and that the way we view this problem has more to do with sort of outmoded notions, although I don't think you use that word, of people breaking into our house and stealing information, whereas today we're faced by completely different circumstances. Do we need to just totally do away with old Fourth Amendment jurisprudence? Do we need to totally shift our focus? And what's different today?
Right. So I'm attached to the Fourth Amendment. And, you know, it's a lovely document. It's very short. It doesn't say all that much. And what it says leaves, in this arena anyway, a huge amount unanswered. Now, somebody's got to answer those questions. Some of that will take care of itself organically as you kind of apply Fourth Amendment doctrine to new circumstances, and some of it won't. And so for purposes of counterterrorism, the Fourth Amendment is actually not the operative document. Because the Fourth Amendment, sort of Fourth Amendment values were kind of implemented through FISA. And FISA was an effort to say, okay, we want to apply ideas from the Fourth Amendment in, you know, in statute and really regulate it in a very kind of specific and much more elaborated way. And FISA, I do think, you know, Congress has really labored over many years to try to keep it up to date, including this year. It's the area in which Congress has behaved most like what I would want to see Congress behave like. So I'd love to tell you that actually there's no problem, and you know, when Congress does what Wittes says, everything works. And the trouble is I can't, because Congress has really faced a very hard challenge with FISA. Legislation takes longer than to create and to implement than Silicon Valley takes to outmode it. And it's very hard to design, even some of the very basic premises operative in FISA are challengeable now. I don't say the statute is useless. It's certainly not useless. But think about it this way. The basic underlying theory of FISA was that if you're, you know, in the United States acting domestically, right, the government has no legitimate interest in listening to your communications, except to the extent it can allege a crime against you, in which case it gets a domestic, regular old domestic wiretap, right? To the extent that you're talking to somebody and you're operating on behalf of a foreign power, even if you're operating domestically, there's a foreign policy interest in what you're doing. And that's not a traditional criminal setting. That surveillance traditionally is regarded as an act of foreign policy. So FISA sets up this very different understanding of how to treat the person who is operating on behalf of a foreign power from the person who's operating maybe criminally domestically. And then to take an additional step, it says there's something sacred about the territory of the United States. So if you're here, you're going to be under a different set of rules than if you're overseas. Now, all of these premises, oh, and then there's one other dimension which is implicit in this, which is that we know where you are, right? Because when FISA's passed, your phone is sitting there on your desk. We know where that phone is. We know what kind of communications device you're using. Now, all of these problems, all these assumptions are at least complicated today, right? Terrorist groups have domestic cells. Are they foreign-based? Are they domestic? This is very different from being a spy for the Soviet Union. Then there's this, you know, question of, are you here? Well, we don't really know. If you're punching your BlackBerry, somebody gets an email. Email communications make all of this very difficult. You punch something into your BlackBerry, you could be in Canada, you could be in Mozambique. And then finally, you know, there's this, you know, so you have across these areas, you have this problem that technology, you know, makes questions that are theoretically easy practically very difficult, to the point that the basic premises, I think, require some discussion and revision.
Thank you very much. I truly enjoyed your presentation. I'm Mark Richard, formerly with the Department of Justice. Just one observation, if I may. Our efforts against terrorists did not begin with 9/11, obviously, and there's a whole body of practice and law that has been engaged in pre-9/11 addressing many of the issues you mentioned. For example, the whole question of use of Guantanamo. Guantanamo did not begin with 9/11, but rather was used in a variety of other settings where we didn't want to bring individuals into the United States, which would trigger a variety of rights for them, and yet we had to keep them in detention in some fashion. Likewise, the whole question of interrogation, trickery, and other devices and stratagems that can be employed have been developed over the years with respect to criminal investigations and prosecutions. So there's a whole body of practice and law that has been approved by the courts with respect to how far you can go in deceiving someone under detention in terms of threats and misstatements of fact and so forth. So I would just voice a little concern that we're not beginning afresh when there is already a whole body of litigation and law and practice and procedures dealing with this area, especially where you have a mixed bag when you're dealing with terrorism, where some of the cases are going to be criminal in nature, where you're going to want to develop criminal prosecutions, while others do not lend itself to a criminal prosecution. So you have I think, a danger of having two compartmentalized systems if you're not careful. Thank you.
Your point is very well taken. Concerning Guantanamo, I have a sort of extended discussion in the book about the sort of areas of continuity between pre-9/11 law and post-9/11 law, the basic thesis of which is that there's actually a great deal more continuity than either the administration, which likes to think of itself as, you know, having fundamentally had a paradigm shift on a particular day, and its critics, who like to think of us as having been governed by the rule of law until 9/11, and then everything went out the window. They all sort of agree that this was a great, you know, a great day of shift, right? And my argument is that actually the shift begins very substantially before 9/11 and was kind of catalyzed by 9/11, but is really movement along a spectrum, not, you know, a sort of pirouette. I agree with you that we need to be cognizant of a large body of law that exists. I guess where I disagree with you, or where I disagree with the implications of your comments, is I think right now we're faced with a situation in which we're capturing, not right now, but in general, fairly large numbers of people who could plausibly be put in any numbers of several boxes. And there's no, other than executive convenience at any given moment in time, there's really no guiding principle for what box they go in. And I think that's a situation that is momentarily convenient for the executive, but in the long run, very detrimental in the sense that it undermines our sense of having, you know, a consistent set of rules written in advance to handle, if you take between Jose Padilla, Yasser Hamdi, Almari, right, and these are all people who we say are fighting for the other side, and we handle them in dramatically different fashions. And that's not a situation that you can do forever without a lot of damage to your sort of sense of yourself as a society that operates under rules.
I have actually two questions, and the first one is, don't we really have to step back and take a longer look when we're dealing with the question of treatment of prisoners and examine the fact that we are in a situation which may have been brought about by the breaking of laws by our own government and put us in a situation in Iraq which wasn't necessarily directly related to terrorism, and some people see as an occupation rather than a war, and consequently we may have created criminals when Iraqis saw it that way and decided to act against an occupation? And the second question is, how would a world court treat these things?
Let me deal with the second question very briefly. I one of the great joys of this book was writing this book was not thinking about Iraq. And I specifically do not deal with the question of the propriety of invasion of Iraq. It's not a subject about which I have terribly coherent thoughts to begin with. But Iraq is a very conventional theater conflict in many ways. One country decides to invade the other country, you have a fight against its military, and then you have a fight against irregular forces that post-date the defeat of the military. This is the situation the Geneva Conventions were written to deal with. And it poses no fundamental challenges as a legal matter to our understanding of the way we fight conflicts, fight wars. There is a different thing going on in the war against al-Qaeda, or the conflict with al-Qaeda, if you don't like calling it a war, which is a stateless group of actors of global reach. They're not based anywhere. They operate without regard to the laws of war. They operate without identifying themselves with any kind of precision. They fundamentally challenge the premises that the Geneva Conventions and that the entirety of the laws of war assume. And I think that is the situation that, you know, we're holding 25,000 people in Iraq, and there's no great controversy about that. You know, that's what happens in the context of a long-term military engagement. You capture the enemy, you detain them. 250 people at Guantanamo, it's very controversial. And the reason is nothing to do with the merits of the invasion of Iraq versus Afghanistan. The reason has to do with the difficulty of identifying that group of people, and the murkiness associated with the question of when this conflict, if ever, will end. And so I very much distinguish between the circumstances of Iraq and the circumstances of the broader fight against al-Qaeda. In response to your second question, I actually think there's a bigger place for international justice in this than the administration acknowledged. And you know, one of the great problems that they've had in bringing people to trial is that the U.S. Constitution puts all kinds of limits on what you can do in the context of a criminal trial. For example, certain hearsay testimony, to the extent that it's testimonial in nature, the Sixth Amendment doesn't let you admit. This is not a problem in international tribunals, actually. Hearsay testimony is presumptively admissible in continental European justice systems. And so I think there was actually some of the issues that led to the creation of military commissions could have actually been alleviated through, you know, creating tribunals with much greater international acceptance that did not actually have to comply with the strict terms of the U.S. Constitution.
Hi, sir. Thank you so much for your talk today. My question is about next steps with regard to Congress. For the past 7 years, Congress has reacted primarily to adverse legal decisions, executive harangues, and the occasional public outcry. So sort of taken as a given the suggestions you have in these areas, how would, you know, the next administration, because that's, you know, really what we're talking about at that point, get Congress to enact pragmatic, practical, bipartisan reform on these very, very controversial and now charged issues? And are there any sort of structural reforms that you would suggest with regards to Congress to allow these needed changes to be brought into practice and to law?
So there's a paradox inherent in your question, which is, or at least maybe there's a paradox in my answer to your question, which is I think the first answer to your question is that you have to have an administration that believes in working with Congress if you want to get anything done with Congress. And the good news in that regard is that actually both of the current candidates for president, I think, have a fundamentally different attitude toward working with Congress on this stuff than the current administration does. And I think it's very hard for me to imagine either of them taking the sort of executive-centric view of this that the current administration takes. The prerequisite, and this is the paradox, the prerequisite for a strong congressional and serious and sustained congressional role in this is executive leadership. And this is the most fundamental misunderstanding on the part of the Bush administration. They saw this as a series of areas in which to assert executive authority. They saw going to Congress as a show of weakness. They did not see going to Congress as a mechanism for strengthening executive power. They did not see going to Congress as that congressional authority depends on executive authority here, and executive authority depends on a buy-in from Congress. Now, the result is that they weakened both executive power and congressional power. And I'll give you just one example of that, which is actually Mark Richards alluded to earlier, which is Guantanamo. Each of the last three administrations has used Guantanamo to hold people whom we did not want to bring into the United States, in part because we did not want to litigate over them in U.S. federal courts. Only one of the last three administrations will leave office having made it impossible for any future administration to do that. That would be the current administration. And I think that the failure to involve Congress in a serious way in the decisions about Guantanamo, which were, by the way, in my judgment, largely defensible, is a big part of that. And so I think you have to see congressional and executive power here as interlaced with one another and mutually dependent. And I think the prerequisite to a good congressional role here is an executive that wants to engage it and wants and sees congressional power as essential to the maintenance of a strong executive.
I was wondering if you see any parallels between what's occurring with the legal landscape for terrorism and what occurred in Italy through the 90s, where they had an organized crime problem, which clearly threatened, basically organized crime became almost a separate government, which threatened their current government. And they changed lots of laws in order to be very repressive and destroy parts of that organized crime. Do you see the same sorts of forces and the parallels there?
I don't. And I actually see only limited power. That's a very interesting example, which I've actually never heard before. The examples that people raise all the time is the Italian experience with the Red Brigades, the German experience with Bader-Meinhof, the Israeli experience with any number of Palestinian groups, and the British experience with the IRA. The problem with these analogies, and they're useful up to a point, but the problem with them is that they all involve domestic-based, organically developed groups. And what's unique about the American experience right now is that the group that we're fighting against is not local. In fact, it's an open question whether there are any al-Qaeda activists in the United States right now. And so it involves necessarily the projection of force overseas in a way that, you know, Italy never had to contemplate. Even Israel, which, you know, their idea of an overseas terrorist organization is the West Bank, right, or Hezbollah, right, which is, you know, over a very short space of distance. And there's a detail and an intimacy there that you don't have when you're operating, you know, the people at Guantanamo now, some of them were captured in Bosnia, some of them are captured in Afghanistan, some of them are captured by Pakistani forces. You know, so you're talking about a global conflict. And I think that does defy analogy to any localized, to any localized conflict with, you know, in this case, organized crime, but, you know, more typically with terrorist groups.
Hi, I find the public discussion on torture somewhat confused in that it conflates two things that should be remain separate. One is an empirical question about whether torture works. You hear that from some experts in interrogation that you get poor information and it's no good. On the other hand, with the policy of rendition, the people in charge of interrogation now for the CIA apparently do believe that putting people in places where they can torture them is effective. The other question, of course, is whether it's in the best interest of the United States to engage in that tactic. If it is, in fact, useful for some things to torture people, do you have any idea about a source that I could look at and get information on the effectiveness of torture? Has this been looked at? It's a discussion that we have frequently,
It's an excellent question. You can start at chapter 7 of my book, which has a survey of the literature, a sort of brief survey of the literature. But the short answer to your question is that you're exactly right that these issues are conflated, and they're conflated with still a third issue, which is a moral issue. You know, assuming it works and assuming it's in our national interest to do it, it's wrong, or it's not wrong. And they all get blended together. I describe it in the book as an argument in moral philosophy posing as an argument in pragmatism. But it really, there is a very great failure, actually, to look at the empirical side. And the reason is that the empirical side is actually enormously underdeveloped. So the one truly good thing that has ever been published that I know of on this subject is a volume that was published in 2006 by a group called the Intelligence Science Board called Educing Information. It's kind of an unwieldy title. And it's a series of papers by this group that kind of looks at the question of what we know about what works. And they're generally pretty skeptical of the use of coercive tactics. And yet, the summary of what works, the ultimate paper of what do we know about what works, says the basic answer to the question is we don't know if coercive tactics work. And for that matter, the 17 non-coercive tactics that have been approved for 30 years by the military, we don't know if they work either. We really don't know very much at all about what works in interrogation. And in my experience, anyway, if you talk to people who engage in non-coercive interrogation, they're convinced that, the FBI guys are convinced that only non-coercive sort of rapport-building stuff works. Military interrogators swear by the Army Field Manual. The Israelis think we're all, amateurs at this, and only their stuff works. And people who've engaged in coercive interrogation, and, General Hayden is testified to this very publicly, as has McConnell, that the CIA's program, which involved some highly coercive techniques, sort of most famously waterboarding, but others as well, saved countless American lives. And I actually don't think there is an empirical literature that resolves that. And I think you have to, at some level, you're going on your gut about what you believe in that regard. What I argue in the book is that in the face of that uncertainty, when you're confronted by a truly high-stakes interrogation, like, for example, KSM or Abu Zubaydah, and your standard techniques fail, the pressure to use coercive techniques is enormous because might work looks a whole lot better than isn't working. But that's, I think, about all you can say in terms of what works in this area. I think the answer is we need more research in it, and it's research that's very hard to do because you can't institutional review boards don't generally give approval to torturing people.
Benjamin Wittes brings real clarity in his book Law and the Long War. He will be signing copies of the book after the forum. The notion that the public and the Congress ought to be involved in designing the new legal structure is refreshing, and you deserve enormous credit for bringing it to the public forum with such lucidity. Thank you.
Thank you.